You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
All right, so here we are in an unmoderated format. So I'm just going to start by introducing myself. I'm delighted to be here with Tom Wright of the Brookings Institution. He will introduce himself. My name is Stephen Wertheim. I am a senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I believe I'm also a visiting faculty fellow at the Center for Global Legal Challenges at Yale Law School. Although, as you can maybe see, the town behind me is Washington, D.C., so that's my full-time job at this point. And I think I'm here in part to represent a kind of restraint school of thinking that has gained steam in our public conversation and in policy over the past couple years. Tom, do you want to say hi?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen, and congratulations on your recent appointment, I think, to the American Statecraft Program at Carnegie. If we were back in the office, it would be great to be having you as a neighbor, but since we're still virtual until September, we'll have to wait till the fall, but delighted to see that. And, you know, my name is Tom Wright. I direct the Center for the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, where I'm also a senior fellow in the Project in International Order and Strategy. And Stephen and I have had the pleasure of debating each other, I think, as sort of representatives of maybe Stephen on the restraint side and me maybe on the liberal internationalist side, both in person and in print over the last couple of years. So really looking forward to today, although it's unmoderated. So it'll be less of a debate and hopefully more of a conversation. But Stephen, I think we had talked about maybe getting, you know, we want lots of things we want to touch on, obviously Afghanistan, you know, China, NATO, all of that. But I think we talked about maybe just starting out, you know, 6 months or so into the Biden administration from each of our perspectives. You know, what does it look like? Is it better or worse? Or what are some of the main things that sort of stand out in terms of what we expected maybe on January 19th?
Sure. All right. Happy to take that one, Tom. Great to be with you. So I would say it's not terribly different after 6 months from what I expected. What I expected was a continuation of a shift that began under the Trump administration, at least in explicit terms, toward great power competition and away from U.S. military involvement in the greater Middle East. I think in somewhat different verbiage, that so far is what we're seeing from the Biden administration, with a greater emphasis on China than Russia, it appears. And so, you know, I have concerns about that approach, but from an analytical point of view, it's pretty much in line with what I expected. I will say the brightest part of the Biden administration's performance to date for me was the decision to end the U.S. Ground presence in Afghanistan. It was not obvious that this is what the Biden administration was going to do, not least because in the campaign, it didn't signal such a decisive approach to ending the U.S. War effort, at least in its ground war capacity. And I thought the language that Biden used to explain himself, to explain his reasoning, saying that it was essentially unacceptable for the United States to engage in forever war, is quite significant. And that logic, I think, applies to a few other cases, which we can talk about as well. So I see some potential there. But obviously, I'd like to see the United States play a significantly smaller military role in the world. And as much as I like what the administration is doing with respect to Afghanistan, I'm not particularly sanguine about its willingness to actually downsize the U.S. military role in the world. So how do you see it, Tom?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I think like you, you know, it's not, it's broadly in line with what I expected, but there's a couple of things I think that were a little bit surprising. I mean, we'll probably differ in how we, you know, welcome it or not. But to me, I thought it was interesting on China. I don't think it was obvious in November that they were necessarily going to take the tack on China that they were going to take. I mean, there was definitely going to be people in the administration who are arguing for a competitive approach toward China, particularly on technology and wanting to pivot more dramatically to the Indo-Pacific. But it was also possible that that would be pretty contested. And there was some evidence that Biden himself, you know, was sort of open to both positions and, you know, needed to be persuaded on them depending on the circumstances, which is pretty normal. But then he, I think, did actually take a decision to go sort of very much in a particular direction. And we have a team, I think it's a very strong team in Asia, but, you know, it's a team that I think is sort of primarily, you know, believes that the U.S. ought to be primarily focused on the Indo-Pacific. They are, I think, quite worried about Xi Jinping and China. I think it's a more nuanced position that's often caricatured. I mean, they believe that there will be continued diplomacy and that there needs to be cooperation in certain areas. But I would say they have a greater degree of urgency maybe than one might have expected at the beginning. And that has been sort of the organizing principle to the extent that there's been one. And Biden himself, I think an interesting thing, and you mentioned it in Afghanistan, but, you know, I think at the beginning of an administration, analysts often look at the advisors or who's in this position, who's in that position. And sometimes they forget about the president, you know, who is, of course, the most important person in their own administration. And as time goes on, the president, usually whoever it is, usually it can take quite a while on certain occasions, but they sort of acquire a voice and an opinion, and that begins to drive things. I think that's happened pretty early with this president, actually. I think he is, you know, he's beginning to do that. I think on Afghanistan, that was him. You know, if it wasn't for him, I think they probably would have kept a small force, you know, in there. But I think he, you know, obviously has been engaged with this issue. He's been in Afghanistan many, many, many times. And of course, his son served in combat. And, you know, I think he's been, you know, maybe of the view that Obama's initial sort of surge was a mistake. I'm not sure how much it applies to other theaters actually with him, but I think he, you know, this was something he strongly felt, and it was sort of the decisive intervention. So I think it's been interesting, but I think yes, mainly sort of Indo-Pacific. The other thing that's really stands out, which I think they're still working through, is on economics, you know, where they do on trade and the international side. I'd say it's, you know, they're going in a different direction. I don't think they fully know exactly where that's going to end up. You know, I think the tax piece was very positive. You know, it showed how, if you think about the international economic agenda a little bit differently, you can make big progress. Doesn't necessarily have to be on free trade agreements and tariff, you know, reduction and regulatory alignment. So they got the beginnings of this deal at the G7 on international tax. But I would say there's still a lot of questions internationally about what that means. So, yeah, I think, you know, a good sort of start. But the other thing that's sort of hovering in the background is, you know, is this the beginning of a new period of internationalism, or will we see a return of America first? And I guess my sort of concern, particularly on Europe, is that I worry that any progress could be easily reversed. And I think, you know, we need to think about this period of time as a relatively finite period of time, may or may not be finite in terms of 3.5 years, but let's just assume it is, and Trump comes back or DeSantis wins in, you know, 2024. The question really is, what could we have done now that will actually transform, you know, the alliances or the general situation so that Europe or others are more resilient and more capable at the end of it, less susceptible maybe to political shocks from over here than they were a few years ago. And I'm not sure I see that yet, actually. And so I think, to me, the Europe piece is a bit more, you know, of a return to the Obama era, whereas the Asia piece, I think, is more of a departure, and the economic piece from Obama.
Well, that sounds pretty good to me. So I'm getting worried that we're going to agree too much.
Oh, I doubt it.
So let me try to stir the pot a little bit. So I was reading your very perceptive piece in The Atlantic on the Biden doctrine. And I'm also listening to you say that, you know, you're worried about a return to America first, whether it's in the form of Donald Trump personally becoming president again or a Trumpy Republican. Shouldn't you be pretty happy with not just the trajectory of American foreign policy so far under Biden, but also under Trump himself? And thus, why would you be so worried about the return of Trump? Because it was under Trump that great power competition became a paradigm, became ubiquitous in the bureaucracy and in the public debate, enshrined in the national defense strategy in the Trump era Pentagon. If you look at Trump's own record toward Europe, you know, taking aside the rhetorical browbeating, which is not uncommon by U.S. administration since the beginning of NATO, Trump took it to a different level, being particularly uncouth. But nevertheless, his actions with respect to Russia, increases of U.S. forces in Eastern Europe, continued expansion of the NATO military alliance to North Macedonia, to Montenegro, you know, that doesn't suggest to me that Trump was out to, you know, wreck the basic patterns, at least on the security side, of U.S. Leadership in Europe in the post-Cold War era, and doesn't therefore suggest to me that a return of someone like Trump would herald a different course. Now, of course, he made noises in other directions, so one never knows. But how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question, and there's a lot there and a lot I could quibble with, but I'll maybe save the quibbles for a minute. I think that the big point, I guess, to try to answer your question is, I mean, I think what it fundamentally comes down to is, you know, democracy and sort of liberal democracy, right? And so I think Trump was basically an opponent, I mean, at least neutral, more likely hostile to liberal democracy, constitutionalism, not just in the United States, but internationally. And he basically, if you think about, if you posit, and I know we don't really agree on this, but if you posit there is this difference to constellations between authoritarianism and democracy, you know, Trump was president of the United States, but his sympathies were with the authoritarian worldview, right? I mean, that was his worldview was not entirely dissimilar to Xi Jinping's or Vladimir Putin's. And, you know, there's a lot of antibodies in the system, right? So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't all collapse at once. It's a pretty, you know, Western, we like the term Western, but liberal democracies, as we think of it, whether it's Japan and Australia, South Korea, or in Europe, you know, Western Europe and Central and Eastern Europe, you know, they're pretty resilient, but they did begin to buckle. And I think particularly in Europe, you saw the sort of strong man of authoritarianism, you know, gain traction in Hungary, obviously, and Slovenia and Poland, but also more generally, not necessarily to the government level. And to me, that was a pretty existential threat to NATO, right? It was, you know, if he and his hostility to and failure to understand in any way Germany, his general hostility to Western European democracies in particular, his attempt to bully them. I mean, to me, that was all hugely concerning. And, you know, yes, I've written in favor of focusing more on great power competition, but always really with an eye to what the U.S. is sort of representing, right? And if is it for a set of imperfect and incomplete sort of value system that tries to lay a certain sort of floor or a benchmark of things that we aspire to and work toward internationally, or is it more of a law of the jungle sort of free for all in which these things are sort of used sometimes instrumentally to beat someone else over the head with? You know, I think Pompeo represented that, you know, maybe a lot in his diplomacy, where it doesn't actually really matter. And the U.S. is perfectly willing to go along with egregious abuses of human rights or, you know, authoritarian takeovers. And so that would be the main thing. I would just also say, you know, that Trump's foreign policy, you know, obviously was, something we all studied quite a lot. I mean, he never really bought into a great barrel competition thing. Like he never mentioned it really, even when he introduced a national security strategy. So you always had these two tracks. I mean, I think Trump always believed in, he believed, you know, the main threats were immigration, trade, maybe initially sort of nuclear weapons from North Korea, and sort of terrorism, right? Those are his general, and alliances. He actually thought alliances were a threat to the US as well. Whereas the Hajor McMasters of the world, you know, in the sense that he thought they were trying to take advantage of the United States, yes. He wanted to reverse that. And then you have the official track, the Hajor, you know, track that was all great power competition and all of that stuff. And those were sort of in parallel. Having just, you know, just finished this book on COVID, I would say that it was interesting. He was a lot of the people we interviewed for this book from within the administration said that he flipped on China in March of 2020 because he felt betrayed on COVID, you know, and so he endorsed a lot of measures that he had previously resisted in terms of balancing against, you know, China. So it's just an interesting trajectory. But no, I think he, to me, is an existential, you know, threat to traditional American foreign policy. But I do take the point that, you know, we now have a 4-year track record, you know, that we can, you know, that we can study. And there are parts of that, obviously, you know, where different elements of the system, you know, were, like, particularly in NATO, you know, bolstered that to some degree. Although I think he never, you know, for most of that European security deterrence initiative, it's very unclear whether he was even aware that those funds were going there. But
right. I mean, the fact that he might not have been aware of a lot of things or didn't care enough to use his power as president and commander in chief to force policy changes, to appoint people who were not like H.R. McMaster, that does indicate something, right? And if we look at the structure of American power, consider some of America's authoritarian allies and partners, or increasingly illiberal ones, not much of that can be attributed to being inspired by what we agree is Trump's baleful rhetoric and sympathy sometimes with strongman rule. You know, you take the trajectory of Turkey. So, you know, take NATO, Turkey, Hungary, Poland, take the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Israel, Egypt, in Asia, increasing U.S. cooperation with the Philippines and India on security matters. I mean, those must trouble you, right? I mean, as somebody who wants the United States to stand strongly for liberal democracies, these are mostly longstanding relationships, right? And how do you square that with a free world?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, just on the, I think that the authoritarianism is obviously a separate, you know, it's a broader trend than Trump, right? Trump is both a reflection of that trend and driving it also, you know, so he benefits from it. What happens elsewhere happens in America, you know, he also, I think, you know, drives it. And even if you look at an egregious example like Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia is never a democracy, always authoritarian. But I think you can definitely make a case that, you know, Trump emboldened him to basically not think that there were any consequences for anything he did, because they would never, there was sure, no risk of even a reprimand, you know, whereas I think when he thought Hillary Clinton was going to win or when Obama was, you know, president, it was like, well, they may create a little bit of trouble. Now, maybe not as much trouble as you or I would like actually on this issue, but there was something there. So it was like a blank check to all of them to, you know, and that there would be no, you'd be rewarded, right? And you know, Duda in Poland, you know, he gets this visit on the eve of the election, comes over,
right?
You know, so I think there's all of that. On the larger question, I mean, look, I've changed my view a little bit on this, not in that I ever had a different view, but I maybe emphasize it a bit more. I do think that if the US is going to be sort of standing for democracy and a certain set of values internationally, that that we need to be doing costly things to make that clear on our own side. Right now, I think that there are, geopolitics is geopolitics, and you can't afford to be consistent all the time in this stuff. But I would say that there's a difference between working constructively with a country like Vietnam, which is strategically important vis-a-vis China, and also for the most part has been generally sort of stable, right? You haven't seen major sort of spikes in bad behavior or anything. And then, basically embracing a country like Hungary, which is not as strategically important and whose leader has been doing pretty egregious things, you know, within the EU and on freedom of speech and the courts and education and other things. And so I would say that we should be sending a pretty clear message. And I do think the Biden administration should have been much tougher early on Saudi Arabia, you know, in terms of sending the, not sort of this recalibration sort of idea, but being sort of stronger in that. And I think that a lot of these leaders who are allied with the United States, authoritarian leaders, should be losing sleep about the impact of their actions on the relationship right now. That is not to say that we won't cooperate with countries if there's a mutual interest and a need to do so, but there's a huge difference between that and sort of a deep alliance based on sort of mutual respect and values in which they benefit a lot from that, right? And so I would be more strict about that, I think. But I think we do need to be, we do need to be conscious of that and to push back a lot more and to realize that most of the time, a lot of these allies, the authoritarian allies, need the United States more, than the United States needs them. And just the final point I make is on Turkey, we have to some extent seen that on Turkey, right? Like Biden has actually taken a pretty tough stance on Erdogan. And it hasn't fallen apart. Actually, Erdogan is, there's some signs that he's not changed. He's never going to do that. But there's certainly some signs that it's become a little bit more predictable because he's worried about what Biden might do, right, with the genocide declaration and other things that they've done. And so, I think we should be transactional and tough on these things when the values bumps up against the, against these longstanding relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, to pull back to some of the differences maybe in our larger worldview, my worry in listening to you is that you are taking rhetoric too seriously. When I look at the actual changes in U.S. foreign policy from, George W. Bush to Obama to Trump, or at least the Trump administration, right, to Biden, with respect to the U.S. record in defending or promoting democracy, liberalism, and human rights, and partnering with countries that don't do that, including one of the most repressive countries in the world, Saudi Arabia, I don't see a huge difference. And I worry that, we can tinker around the margins with Turkey or with Saudi Arabia or something, but to me, that just doesn't seem like the operating principle of U.S. foreign policy is, in fact, to defend democracies as such against authoritarian powers. And, the problem for me is that the United States has overextended itself and identified problems in the world that just don't pose a threat to the United States. And therefore gotten itself into a situation where we have all these relationships that we seem to be wedded to. And so the issue for me isn't that, I think if there's a threat to the United States itself and our vital interests, that is, the survival of the United States physically, the ability of Americans to be prosperous. Yes, we should have security relationships and take other actions that protect those interests. And that, might be true. I don't think that needs to unfold along strictly democratic lines versus authoritarian lines. If our survival is at stake, that's existential, literally, right? But what makes it gratuitous to me is that we have over-identified our interests in the world and created sprawling military relationships that, you know, not only have we done that, to me, at a loss to our own security, but then we end up, you know, having these intimate relationships with countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and on down the line, where really we're just going to we think that these relationships are crucial to our security. I don't think they're not. And so the problem to me is not just hypocrisy. I think hypocrisy is going to be part of the way of the world, right, to some degree. But it's a there's a gratuitousness to these relationships.
Yeah. So just on that, I mean, I think there's a, again, you know, the great set of questions. There's a lot there. I mean, I think, you know, I might sort of respond by maybe elaborating, I think, what some of our differences are. I mean, I think just I'll get to the Middle East point in a second, but I think one difference between us and also restrainers and sort of liberal internationalists is that, you know, restrainers, I think, will often identify, you know, the more problematic relationships or track record that the U.S. has acquired over the last number of decades, right? And so when we talk about, you know, democracy, it will be, you know, sort of Iran and like 1953 or Allende and you know, all of that sort of list of things, right? And then in the present day, some of the relationships you mentioned, particularly sort of Saudi Arabia, and it's like how, you know, Pat Porter's book is sort of a lot about this, like how can you say the words liberal international order with a straight face, right, when all of this happens? And I think on our side, we would, I think it's fair that we haven't, you know, that has sometimes not been sort of the focus of attention, right? What we would sort of focus on is what the U.S. has accomplished at the core, right, and say, well, the European Union is the direct result of, you know, U.S. military engagement in Europe, right? Wouldn't have happened without NATO, without that presence. And what you have there is really valuable and it's working. And, you know, the fact there are some troops in Germany, you know, let's not worry too much about that, you know, because actually they would probably cost more here anyway. And that's just a huge benefit. And similarly in Northeast Asia, you know, particularly with South Korea and Japan, you know, you can sort of make a similar sort of argument. And so for us, we feel frustrated sometimes that you guys sort of ignore, you know, the core benefits and sort of assume that would happen anyway, right? And, you know, that, you know, of course we're in favor of keeping that. No one wants to, you know, cause Japan or Germany or France to implode. And, you know, you would say, well, that wouldn't happen now. You could pull out and it would be fine. But I think that's sort of the, you know, to some extent we're, I mean, it would be wrong to say sort of periphery and core, because that's, I don't mean it to sound pejorative, but I think we're sort of placing value and cost on different things, as it were. And I think on our side, I think, of course, you know, I think people want to try to reduce, you know, the mistakes, right? No one is like, let's go and repeat something that, you know, went wrong. I think you would say that's sort of endemic, you know, to the policy. But I think on the other side, I think that the, you know, the big, I mean, I think, and you make it in a very intellectually honest way, but the larger version of restraint, I think, frightens a lot of us because it's such sort of a revolutionary sort of change, you know, in terms of U.S. foreign policy, that we believe that will have repercussions on these core sort of accomplishments that we all sort of value so much. And, you know, obviously when you talk to the, you know, to those countries and pretty much across the political spectrum in those countries, you know, they have a similar view for the most part. And so I think that's what's sort of interesting to me, is that sort of, I don't know if you agree with that framing or not, but.
I think there's truth in the idea that, you know, different geographies are emphasized. Those who are more non-interventionist will look at the U.S. record in the global South, which is where most of humanity is. So I think that should matter, and recite a list that you began to recite. But I think with respect to the so-called core, you know, yeah, I think American power has been pretty good to Western Europe for many decades. But is that everything? And does that actually benefit the United States? You made a good case for the Cold War just now. You made a good case for NATO as long as there was a Soviet communist threat. I don't think you made a good case for continuing U.S. forward deployments and trying to be the dominant military power in each region after 1991. And it's been 3 decades now. So why don't we return to some of this? I want to get, first of all, to the region that where I think the U.S. quest for military primacy has proved most destructive. I'm sure you'd agree with that assessment, which is the greater Middle East. And then let's turn more to the core, so-called core, and address European security and the large issue of China now. So with respect to Afghanistan, I mean, this for me is the bright spot of the Biden administration foreign policy so far. I think you were right in what you said earlier, that we see the president himself come out in how he talks about Afghanistan. When he's challenged by reporters, you can tell he has got a core to what he's saying. And that also, by the way, I think came out in his messaging around the European summits a few weeks ago in defending the value of diplomacy, even with Vladimir Putin. And I thought that was a praiseworthy aspect that was coming. It seemed to be coming distinctly from President Biden himself. All right, so back to Afghanistan. I'm rambling. Do you think that Biden made the right decision to terminate the U.S. ground war in Afghanistan? I certainly do. And are there aspects of it that you would have liked to see the administration handle differently, particularly in light of the recent gains by the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, not to avoid the question, to give you a straight answer. On balance, yeah, I do think he made the right decision, but I'm a lot more torn about it than you are. And find it a lot more traumatic, maybe, in terms of, you know, how I sort of think about it. I mean, the way I think the debate is basically, you know, do you have a small insurance policy of 4,000 or 5,000 troops in Afghanistan to keep a lid on things indefinitely because you're worried about what's going to happen next, right? And you just do that in perpetuity until things change dramatically one way or the other. So that's sort of one side of it. And the other side of it is, you know, we've been doing this for decades. You know, there is no end goal in sight. You know, lots of problems emerge on that. The U.S. can get drawn into a larger fight there. And, you know, we have no obligation. We need to leave. And then on top of that, there's a pivot to Asia argument, you know, which is, look, we have the Department of Defense focused on these operations on a daily basis, and that takes up a huge amount of bandwidth. And I set that part aside, I think. But I think that's I have a lot of sympathy with the first view, to be honest. I mean, I do think the U.S., yes, the president is right. The U.S. doesn't have, you know, responsibility for deaths that will occur, in a sense that those are the responsibility of those who will commit those actions, and it's up to the people of Afghanistan. But there is a cause and effect here clearly too, right? I mean, the fact that a decision is being made and changing the situation results in a change, you know, in the outcome. And so whether or not we say there's an obligation, so I do, you know, I do have some sympathy with that. But on balance, you know, I don't think it's sustainable to just do that operation in perpetuity. I also think, and I know we'll definitely sort of disagree in this, but I am not convinced that Afghanistan is as strategically important as parts of, you know, Iraq, for instance, or parts of the, you know, core Middle East. And I do think that I thought at the time that, you know, it was a mistake to pull all troops out of Iraq whenever it happened in 2011 or 12, you know, and I think this is maybe, but the bottom line is on Afghanistan, you know, and I wrote this, I think, before he took office. I think, you know, he promised it in the campaign. I think it was something that has broad support. It's extremely tough to do. I think it will be very painful. I'm glad to see them making a big effort on the translators and all of those who helped. And I will be extremely generous and expansive on basically anyone who wants to leave, even though that will leave Afghanistan in a worse situation. But I think there is a moral obligation, and I really hope there's a huge sort of effort expended on that to move toward where I think we disagree. I mean, I think that the, you know, there is a, regardless of how we assess how it started, or, I mean, you know, on terrorism, one can go, you know, we all know the arguments, right? Like in terms of whether there's, you know, someone could argue there's culpability for US policy going back to the 80s versus, you know, this is more indigenous sort of independent. I mean, I think without getting into all of that, I do think there is a continuing ISIS threat that is sort of independent of US policy, right? And I think that to me, as someone who would like to leave the Middle East in a more rapid way, I think it's rendered basically impossible by that, right? Because I think if you see just an abandonment of the region and even of these very problematic allies, there is no good, as I see it, like there's no good reason to think that, you know, ISIS won't be sort of resurgent. And that is actually more felt in Europe than in the United States, you know, where I think they're definitely a greater target and have experienced more horrific sort of attacks. And I think that it is both important from a national security point of view to continue to address that. But I also think even if you set that aside, from a public opinion point of view, people really care about it, right? And the first time you have these major attacks occurring again, you know, public opinion of Congress will shift on a dime, you know, just as it did in 2014, and will end up right back in a much bigger way than before, as happened in 2014. So compared to like 12 and 11 or whatever. So I think that probably gets to the heart of sort of a disagreement. But I think it's really about, you know, how worried are we about what ISIS equivalents, you know, whatever the latest sort of version is.
Right. So I think we do disagree here. I mean, I think you've articulated, with respect to public opinion, you've articulated the problem, which is a cycle of violence. The United States began to station tens of thousands of troops in the Middle East only after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the Persian Gulf War. And we have engaged in a great amount of military action since then. I would agree with you. When the United States is attacked, like on 9/11, the United States has to retaliate. Security is extremely important. In the broader term, though, we have to think about under what conditions can we not make problems for ourselves? And at some point, we have to be willing to say, we have accomplished enough that we can now see if local actors can manage security problems to try to get us to the point where perhaps if the United States is not killing so many people in the greater Middle East routinely, then perhaps people in the Middle East will not, some segment of them, will not want to kill Americans. And I think, you know, it is possible to get to that point.
But was that not tried in 14? I mean, the U.S. had left, ISIS reemerged, and then immediately started planning attacks against, you know, Europeans and Americans, and with the beheadings and the, you know, attacks in France. And
right.
I mean, so there was no, you know, if they were being, I just don't see them as very sort of strategic in the narrow sense. I mean, you know, you could paint a world in which they were like, yeah, the U.S. is gone. We're going to focus on establishing control in this part of Iraq or Syria that we're in, you know, but immediately it was the FAR war. And that's what ideologically motivates a lot of them. And I don't, you know, I guess it's just how much evidence do we need that that is a, you know, that is a problem. And I think it goes way beyond, I mean, with Al-Qaeda, you know, with Bin Laden, it was sort of him making this conscious decision, we're going to focus on the far enemy, you know, and he did that very self-consciously. With ISIS, it's much more, you know, indigenous to just sure. the general makeup of the person who joins up, you know, and, sure. And there's a lot of, as you know, a lot of studies that suggest it's much more internal than it is external. You know, it's much more to do with identity and, you know, just all sorts of questions, especially in Europe, but, you know, with the, you know, all sorts of things that we see with alienation and less to do actually with, you know, with a US foreign policy decision. Although obviously, I mean, there'll be lots of cases where I think, you know, it's probably a bit muddier, but I think that's the, and I don't think that if you left it to the regional allies, as we sort of saw before, I don't think they're capable of dealing with it because they have different priorities. You know, their priority is not necessarily the ISIS guys who are going after, you know, the French or the Americans. It's Iran or it's, you know, their internal security stuff. And I think that's why the U.S. has been, you know, engaged.
Well, there's a whole coalition of actors, including Iran, that went after ISIS in the first place. So, and also, I think U.S. foreign policy did create a context. You're right about the multifaceted causality of what causes people to radicalize, join a group like ISIS, et cetera. But the destabilization of Iraq has quite a bit to do with the rise of a group like ISIS in the first place. But, you know, I think the key question now for us, 2 decades after 9/11, is how can we extricate ourselves from the situation if we can? I think we'd agree we'd like to be able to draw down from the Middle East and not face terrorist attacks that would then draw us back in, right? And so at some point, you've got to say, we have, in fact, crushed ISIS. That is true. And if you apply Biden's logic about forever war, which he applied only to Afghanistan and only ground troops in Afghanistan, if you apply that to Iraq and Syria, I think the logic holds there very well. If the United States is going to maintain thousands of forces in Iraq and Syria combined in order to prevent the hypothetical resurgence of the ISIS group, that is not a mission that can be verifiably achieved. And so that seems to me a recipe for forever war as well. Now, you know, we could step back and at least assess whether the Iraqi government, whether the Syrian government and other forces, Turkey, and perhaps if insofar as you're right that the interests of Europeans are affected, perhaps the Europeans would also find an interest in making sure the ISIS problem doesn't reemerge. But when are we going to be able to say, let's accept victory for an answer?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're, I mean, look, neither of us have access to the assessments, right, in terms of, and I'm not pretending that I know what the, you know, what accurate sort of assessments are on ISIS strength or them being sort of reconstituted, but I certainly don't think they're defeated, you know, in the sense that, you know, the Nazis were defeated, gone and not to come back, right? I mean, I think we saw before with sort of victory being declared, you know, and then vacuums being left, and particularly in northern Iraq, and the way, you know, it plays out in complicated ways, right? It's not necessarily, you know, I think in Iraq it was, you know, it was the sort of abandonment, the Iranian sort of influence and the maybe overzealousness there that then pushed people, you know, into a corner where they were susceptible to ISIS. And so this can take a little bit of time, although it obviously happens pretty rapidly. So I don't, you know, I don't see that they are, that they have vanished as a force. And I think we do need to be worried, you know, about the threat that they could continue to pose. And I don't think that it's possible to do this without the US. You know, I don't have as much confidence in, you know, in the other sort of powers in the region or the allies in Europe to be able to do it on their own. They don't have, for the most part, a huge amount of confidence to do it on their own. Look, I think there's no, you know, I wouldn't sort of go out trying to overly expand the mission, you know, at the outset. But I think what I'm saying is this, you know, as someone who does routinely write that the U.S. needs to focus more on China and, you know, continue to play an important role in Europe and, you know, is frustrated with a lot of the stuff in the Middle East, as I think everyone is, you know, I haven't been able to go to the point that says, let's just disengage. And that's the primary reason why, you know, I think it is something that is, you know, could easily reemerge at any point. And it's not, you know, it's not the 20 years after 9/11 thing to me is not the appropriate, you know, because that sort of indicates that was the last attack. And then we've had these 20 years. We have a lot more recent history, you know, there. And so, so I don't think my sense on Biden, I don't think what they did in Afghanistan is sort of a precedent model that they're looking to implement elsewhere. You know, I would also say, and this probably gets to a philosophical disagreement between us. I mean, I think when you mentioned the forever war, but also on China, I mean, you know, I think to me, restrainers sometimes emphasize for understandable reasons, you know, the U.S. side of that equation. And I know you also would acknowledge that obviously there's another side to it too, but I just think that a lot of this has been foisted upon us, you know, and I think maybe this is a segue to China, but, you know, when I hear a lot of the, you know, new Cold War stuff and, you know, we're getting, it's always assuming it's sort of American policy choices, you know, whereas of course there's at least one other actor here that is also, you know, Xi Jinping in the China case, you know, that is, you know, that maybe we collectively don't spend as much time, you know, thinking about and to the extent to which our policies are a little bit reactive. But I'm just wondering how you think about that. I mean, as you, I know you've had the, you've articulated these views for some time, but like, how do you think about whether or not you vary them depending on like, what's a sufficient level of evidence from Xi Jinping that would like, or let's say, if you want to go back to the Middle East, that would like disprove, falsify, you know, I'm happy to answer that too, but you know, what would sort of cause you to say, well, actually, you know, we can't do that because, you know, it's not being driven by Biden. Actually, it's more of a response to what Xi Jinping is doing.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do want to say as a preamble that what you said for the beginning of your answer, I think really troubles me, which is the sense that we're going to pivot to Asia, but also, you know, conditions are not ripe in the Middle East and Europe, which we haven't talked about, for the United States to really draw down. And so this is the logic of, it seems to me, primacy, even though I know you'd prefer a different term like liberal internationalism. But this is the logic of primacy at work. And I'm very concerned about, you know, if you pivot, you have to pivot from something to something else. And we just haven't been able to do that, even though for more than a decade, you know, starting with the Obama administration.
Just not to, sorry to interrupt, but like, I mean, you could argue, and I would, I guess, that it is a pivot from the Middle East, right? Because it's a narrower mission. I mean, the U.S., engagement at the region has been narrowed and maybe more focused on that sort of on a small number of things. I mean, I know we would maybe disagree about how small those things are, you know, and, you know, we all know the list of them, but I think that's what our side would say is that, you know, it is a, you know, and there actually is some redeployment of troops and, you know, that there has been, you know, not a de-escalation. I think that's the wrong term just because the region is so disorderly. But I think there has been a shift. And I think you're seeing, you know, that in this administration at every level, particularly in personnel and just with the level of attention and energy. But anyway, I think that, you know, you're right, though, that I think, you know, for many of us, you know, I think that there is a sense that the security situation is still, you know, precarious enough that in a way that directly affects, you know, the U.S., that it's just really not really possible, even though I think a lot of people would like to go further if they could.
Right. So, all right. So the comment that it's not really possible gets us to your other question, right? Which is that my complaint about people in your camp, who I would say favor primacy, because I like the term internationalist as well. I'm not going to run from that. So my issue is that so often the United States appears to have no choice, according to people like you or H.R. McMaster, that all these problems in the world are necessarily security problems and really grave threats to the United States itself. And my point is really never, maybe except with respect to something like the war in Iraq in 2003, where I think, you know, the United States launched a war of aggression. It's almost never that the United States is the leading actor in, you know, creating conflict or antagonism. I mean, it always takes two, at least, to create that situation. So I wouldn't say that, you know, the Chinese Communist Party has been a nice actor in the world of late. Certainly not. So it's not about assigning moral blame necessarily, or even causal blame. But I think we constantly put ourselves in the position of trying to pursue dominance basically everywhere in a military sense. We divide regions like the Middle East into friends and implicit or actual enemies. And then we inherit a lot of the conflict that results that has no intrinsic link to the actual interests of the United States. Or we acquire interests, right, by virtue of putting ourselves in these positions that then sometimes do merit a response. But I think of interests in a very different sense. My starting point would be if you can, you know, if you're an alien from outer space looking at the world, what does the United States require to be safe and prosperous, right? Or if you imagine the world as, imagine we could be at a blank slate, you know, from 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. So I have a more intrinsic view of interests. And I do get annoyed when people talk about interests that only exist because we may have made mistakes in putting ourselves here or there.
I mean, it's a bit of a tangent, but it's worth sort of just focusing on for a second. I mean, I find that thinking very alien to my own because, like, there's something, I know you don't mean in this way, but there's something very revolutionary to me about the blank slate idea. You know, it's sort of the year zero, and you know, we can, and actually, you know, it's as you know, I'm an immigrant here obviously, but I think it's a particularly American thing as well, and you often hear with new administrations it's sort of resets or let's not focus on the past, but you know, people focus on the past, right? There's a legacy of things that are inherited. You can't, you know, we're all responsible, you know, if we're in government, for what previous governments have done and the decisions that they made, and we're assessed, you know, because of the, you know, country, not because it's Barack Obama, right, in his background. He's representative of the United States, and the United States has done certain things, you know, that have an impact. And I just, the way I see the world is, you know, we have this international, let's not call it an order, just say an international configuration, you know, at the moment. And there's a lot, you know, that can be said for, if not the status quo, at least incrementalism, before we really sort of tinker around with that, you know. And I think it's, to me, anything that is, you know, and I know our side is engaged in this, you know, as well on occasion, I think not super effectively for the most part, but when we try for you know, like we're just fundamentally imposing a totally new paradigm, you know, which I think restraint would be, and, you know, disengaging from these alliances, whether it's over a 10-year period or a 1-year period or whatever. You know, I think that's hugely consequential, you know, and I think it you know, and I think to me, you know, and based on obviously what all the allies say, potentially very sort of, you know, destabilizing. So I think it's an interesting, I think it is a more, the realist school, I think, as always, which I know you're not necessarily a realist, but I've always thought it's a little curious, you know, because realism, of course, in the sort of Burkean sense, at least, is pretty skeptical of major change, you know, and sort of let's just accept things and try to work sort of on the margin of that, you know, and whereas with a lot of structural realism in international relations, you know, they think that, but then they also think that we should completely remake sort of U.S. foreign policy in the international order to make it more stable. And I know you're, you know, progressive, not a realist. I'm not leveling that at you, but I think it's something I'd be curious about your response, you know, because I think it is a, to me, it's all, and, you know, it's in the debates we had in writing as well, just on the level of change that will be entailed here.
Yeah, I'm a historian too, so I don't believe in year zero ever anywhere. But, so, and I appreciate the need to understand specifically where are we and what are the consequences of change. And I have eminent respect for incrementalism. But how do you know where you want to go, even if it's incremental, unless you engage in the exercise of assessing what is it that the United States truly requires in the world we face? And I think that has been a deficit for this country for some time, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. We had a very changed international environment, but U.S. foreign policy didn't change enough with it, or it changed actually in the direction of increasing the U.S. military footprint or commitments, as well as actually engaging in more armed intervention more frequently than during the Cold War itself. And so I think it is indispensable as a thought exercise, right? Not to say, you know, well, I think the world should be like this, absent where we are right now. And so let's just try to bring that about as quickly as possible, willy-nilly. That's not the point. But it is indispensable, I think, to assess what are America's interests, irrespective of what we've done at this point, given the international environment we face, and then try to bring ourselves in a responsible way more in line with the role that we ought to have in the circumstances we face.
Yeah, no, it's a great sort of explanation. I mean, I think if you look at Europe, where, you know, you mentioned post 91, I mean, I would say, and I know we definitely disagree in this, but, you know, I think
Come on, you want to argue with my New York Times piece from a couple weeks ago. I know you do.
But, you know, I think it's, I think if you look, including at the military interventions in the Balkans, you know, for the most part, I think Europe is in a lot better position today, you know, than it would have been if the U.S. had sort of washed its hands of Europe. And I think that not just because I worry about what would have happened if Milosevic had succeeded. I think we've seen, you know, those embers of authoritarianism and dictatorship, even with his defeat, but I think they would have been turbocharged, you know, had he been a major sort of actor. But I do think, you know, looking at NATO expansion, or what do we call it, enlargement expansion, I lose track of all of these terms, but, you know, NATO being bigger, that, and, you know, and we all obviously go to the Baltics and other countries there, you know, to me, that's a big success, right? Because what will be happening in Ukraine will be happening in Lithuania, Latvia, you know, Estonia, that these will be zones of conflict. There will be a lot greater instability. And so we still have instability, but it's a smaller, you know, it's a smaller bucket, you know, in Europe, and it's more contained than it otherwise would be, in that, you know, the European Union has lots of problems, I think it's been an overwhelming sort of success. And I think this maybe is a little bit of a segue just to the thing we slightly glossed over at the beginning, but I think it's just on democracy and authoritarianism. But I find it interesting to think about the EU sometimes, because, you know, they're not really military, you know, they don't have an army, they engage, you know, to the extent of a restrainer would sort of advocate for the robust use of diplomacy and development. I mean, the EU is almost, a shining example of that in action, you know. And yet, it was over an EU association agreement that Russia moved against Ukraine, not over NATO, you know, in 2013. It was the worry about the EU supporting democracy movements and generally standing up for human rights. And with China today, the EU has maybe tried more than anyone else to engage with China and really has worked very hard and been criticized sometimes by me and others for being too naive about the lengths they've gone to on that. And for the most part, you know, they feel that they've been spurned and that they have, you know, China moving in a more aggressive fashion, you know, against them. And they're trying to figure that out and how to sort of adjust. But I think it's to me that this democracy sort of authoritarianism thing is interesting to look at through the EU prism, you know, in terms of, that this is, we are, I think, you know, I don't think it's the Cold War. I don't think it's dividing the world into blocks because all these countries are interconnected. But I think there are increasingly two different ways of organizing society. And we see that within the United States as well. You know, this is not just an external thing. These struggles are occurring. Authoritarians have lots of people who'd like to be more liberal. Democracies increasingly have lots of people who'd like to be less liberal. But this is a big sort of struggle, and how we engage in that, I guess, is a major question. And I know we're probably running out of time, but just wondering, I mean, by all means, critique everything I said, but I think also it would be really interesting for me to hear just how do you and restrainers think about, you know, the international part of the struggle between whether it's democracy and authoritarianism or illiberal and liberal democracy or whatever I think we know what we mean by it, but whatever you want to call it, like, how do you see that playing out?
So I don't want to speak for anybody but myself on this answer or in general, I'm very concerned actually about the way you, even though you acknowledge that the relevant fault line here does run within countries. Nevertheless, I think the attempt to defend the free world, it's against somebody, and particularly against China and Russia. And that framework, which is congruent with great power competition, but puts an ideological gloss on it, to me, that is quite possibly going to be counterproductive with respect to strengthening democratic forces. I get the argument, which is quite coherent, from the middle of the 20th century, that in a world with totalitarian powers, first the Axis powers, then Soviet-backed communism, right, that genuinely did have different, comprehensively different systems, and were engaging in armed conquest and political domination. I see the logic then of mounting a defense of the free world in order to defend the larger system. Now that came with costs to our own democracy and some benefits as well. We can debate that, but we probably don't want to spend the rest of our few minutes.
We definitely don't have enough time.
Yeah, exactly. But today I think we face a more complicated challenge, and one that will be ill-served by trying to map geopolitical competition onto the struggle for democracy and authoritarianism. I think one of the, just to take our own country, one of the causes of our own democratic decay has been the parade of foreign threats and enemies that the American people have been told over decades. These new set of foreigners are out to get us. I think, and that's been backed by, you know, persistent military action, real violence. I think that's one of the causes, not the only one, but one of the causes of the emergence of a xenophobic and nativist movement with real political power in this country in the 21st century. So I worry about, you know, the attempt to then apply the same kinds of rubrics to China and Russia in this starkly ideological way in which you do. So my view of, you know, I do think it's important to do, as Biden says, demonstrate that democracy can deliver. And I think that's best done by making democracies deliver. And some of the initiatives he wants to undertake that we agree with, like, you know, adjusting the global economy, you know, making sure that we can shut down tax havens, set global minimum taxes. Those are good steps, right, that require international coordination and collaboration. But to, you know, make this to bind up the issue of democracy with a military contest with China and Russia, I fear that is actually prone to weaken our own democracy. And just look at the way Trump himself led the charge against China over the course of his administration, not exactly giving me confidence that a long-range, intense security competition with the world's number two power is going to redound to the benefit of liberal democratic forces in our own country.
But what if, I mean, what if, as happens all the time, you know, countries are, I mean, everyone's under these pressures from a mix of internal and external, but they want assistance or, you know, I'm thinking of a few different examples, you know, like the Australians, for instance, very much the target of Chinese coercive activity. I mean, is standing with them on this stuff and trying to push back? Because a lot of countries are much smaller, obviously, than the US and more vulnerable to Chinese coercive pressures, or in Europe with Russian, you know, attacks and interference, as we saw in the UK, but also, you know, Belarus, like lots of different sort of examples. And even on, I know something that's a favorite of progressives, and, you know, I favor too, but it's interesting in this context on corruption, anti-corruption legislation, you know, everyone seems in favor of that, but that's actually really a dagger targeted at the heart of these regimes. And, you know, if you go after Putin and the oligarch, you know, Putin's cronies funds and China and exposing all of that, I mean, that in a lot of ways is more destabilizing than, you know, moving troops in Eastern Europe, right? Because it's so, you know, these, I guess what I'm curious about is I understand the coherence of the overall frame, what, and I, you know, Bernie Sanders' recent piece, he focused a bit on this, although it's interesting, as you know, I've been critiquing him a bit because he actually started a lot of this at the beginning by giving a speech about, you know, Fulton, Missouri, you know, sort of declaring a struggle between democracy and authoritarianism. But what I'm less clear on are the details. Like, what is it that, apart from the defense budget, I mean, I understand that, but like the opposition to the size of that, but what is the specific things on this competition of democracy and authoritarianism that, let's say, Biden is doing that progressive restrainers feel like we want to reverse that, you know, that that's a mistake other than the rhetoric and the mood?
So I think the reason I think your criticism of Sanders is flawed is that I think the Sanders view makes the kind of distinction that I am also making, which is that the struggle between democracy and authoritarianism fundamentally runs across borders. It's not just to be neatly mapped onto a military contest. And in fact, I would be supportive of a number of actions, multilaterally that would constrain Chinese and Russian behavior, including on corruption, including on trade. I think China's practice of international economic coercion is the single worst international practice China has put forward. You look at Australia of late. I think that's aggressive. I'd be perfectly willing to do more and consult with others to help.
Where do we disagree, though, then, on the actions?
I think where we disagree is on the military element, right? I think I would reserve that instrument for security threats to the United States. And I think we should be careful about lumping all kinds of behavior together that China in particular practices.
But the democracy the Chinese record on is not really military. I mean, as you know, like when Biden talks about it, it's never linked to, it's rarely linked anyway to defense policy. I mean, the defense policy piece is much more traditional. The new piece is the gray zone stuff, the anti-corruption, counter-coercion, counter-illicit interference, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah, but the military actions are, I think, an essential part of this context. I mean, the promise by NATO, very much urged by the United States, of eventual membership for Ukraine and Georgia in 2008, I think is a key part of the context here for the actual armed conflict that's occurred between Russia and Georgia first, and then later between Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. The fact that the United States arms, Ukraine with weapons is also part of that. So if we were having a contest that was actually, you know, limited to the EU, right, we'd be in a different situation. And I'm all for, I believe in our European allies and partners. I believe that they can manage the defense of Europe. That's what I would like to see. So I might be saying something very different with respect to U.S. policy. Yeah.
You think they can do it?
I think Europeans can take the lead in defending Europe. I certainly think that's true. And I think the United States has to be willing to pull back in order to create the context in which that can happen.
I'd like to encourage it, but I don't see them being able to do it independently. But I think we are way over. So
probably true.
Yeah, we could go on for twice the length of time, but to be continued.
I look forward to that. I'm grateful for anybody who has stuck with us.
Yeah,
for this sprawling conversation.
The forever conversation.
Excellent. Well, it was my pleasure, and I do hope we can continue in an even longer format in the future.
Yeah, I look forward to that in person, hopefully. Thanks.
Great.